This is The Conversation. My name is Michael Shaw. Welcome. Thank you for being here. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, where you can find all past episodes, images, links to appropriate places, past, present, and future. My guest today is Walter Robinson. For those of you in New York, you are probably familiar with Walter. If you are not in New York, for those of you who don't know, Walter Robinson is, has been, and will be both an artist and a critic. He was the editor-in-chief of ArtNet magazine for more than a decade, up until a couple years ago. We talk about that. We talk about his art. We talk about what it's like to be a critic. All that is coming up. I had a great chat. Enjoyed chatting with him. What do you know? Turns out artists slash writers know how to have a chat. So all that chatting he's been doing at the art fairs over the years has paid off. So that's coming up in just a moment. I just want to tell you before we get to that, that our affiliate partner today is Made with Color, the website building platform designed by an artist for artists and designers and other creative types who otherwise are not that comfortable building their own websites. Check them out at madewithcolor.com. And if you sign up for a year membership by entering in the code conversation, all lowercase, you will get 29% off your first year of service. That's madewithcolor.com. Let's get to that conversation with Walter now. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you on the back end. So I've got Walter Robinson on the line. Hello, Walter.
Hi, how are you?
All right. How was your vacation?
Oh, it was very restful.
Nice, nice. I was doing an intro to a podcast that I put out the other day, and I was saying how it seemed like every artist I knew last week was out of town. But then that said, isn't this second half of the month going to be even more dead than the first half?
Yes, you know, I should have taken the whole month off.
What kept you from doing that?
Oh, I don't know. You always feel like you've got things to do. I actually have a big exhibition coming up in Normal, Illinois in October, and it requires a certain amount of clerical work on my part, some packing and that kind of stuff. So,
right.
So I do have things to do.
Is it an institutional exhibit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's organized at the University Galleries in Normal, Illinois. It's at the State University there, and the director and curator to those galleries is a guy named Barry Blinderman. He had a commercial art gallery in New York back in the 80s, and then he got the museum job after that, and over the years he's done like monographic shows of all kinds of New York contemporary artists.
What was his commercial gallery in New York?
Well, it wasn't necessarily an A-level gallery. It was called Semaphore Gallery.
I think I've heard of Semaphore.
First, yes, first in West Broadway, and then he opened a second gallery in the East Village. So it was in the early 80s. And then they went out of business, I think. He was one of the first dealers to show the artist Mark Kostabi. If you know who Mark Kostabi is.
I do, and for our listeners who don't, we should give a brief description of him, because this might connect to some of your past in some maybe distant way. Mark Kostabi is sort of tell me if you agree, the quintessential sort of East Village or post-East Village artist. He did figurative sort of mannequin-like work where we'd have these mannequins in these various scenes.
That's right.
That was sort of his style.
All his figures are faceless.
Right, right.
They're faceless, and there's shadow. There's a lot of shadowing, and they're very sort of literal. There's these narrative scenes as a rule. But Mark made quite a reputation for himself in the 80s as being a money hungry artist. He appeared on the cover of New York magazine, for instance, dressed in a suit made of dollar bills.
Right.
He sort of positioned himself as a low rent Andy Warhol.
Right. And he was fairly unapologetic about it, but I think ultimately that kind of came, he pulled out the rug from under him sort of over the long term, wouldn't you say?
Well, he is a fascinating figure because he's still working. He does quite well. He earns several million dollars a year. He has exhibitions in Italy and in the U.S. I think he just had a show at the Martin Lawrence Gallery in Las Vegas,
okay,
which happens to be, I think, the largest gallery, a commercial gallery in the U.S. And the thing about him that's interesting, of course, is that in some ways he represents whether you're cool or not in the art world. If you like Marcus Abi, you're not cool.
Right.
But if you are cool, you don't like Marcus Abi.
Right.
Of course, being a contrarian, I like Mark.
He's a barometer for your level of cool. Did you know him back in the day, and do you know him now to any extent?
Oh, yes. I wrote one of the first reviews of his work, and I included this great anecdote about how he was carrying a painting from his studio over to the gallery, and a person stopped him on the street and bought it from him before he could even get it to the gallery.
Right.
That's like an example of the sort of hype that somehow magically, seems magical, attends to his work.
Right.
Because he does sell a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, you know, what this brings up for me, among many other things, is, isn't he like the perfect example of why the art world needs gatekeepers?
Well, the art world has gatekeepers. I don't know if I draw that conclusion.
I mean, the
art world has gatekeepers, and they do a fairly, it does a fairly good job of keeping Mark out. But as Mark says, you know, there are people in the art world who despise his work, yet there are thousands and thousands of other people who like his work.
Right, right.
So, in his case, you know, the success is its own measure. And when I was the editor of ArtNet magazine for several years, he wrote a column for me.
That's right.
An advice column for artists, and it was called Ask Mark Kostabi. And there is just tons of good advice in there. You know, however you feel about Mark's work, one way or another. And sometimes I like his work. I like his work. Most of the time I like it, I suppose.
Okay.
Very interesting. It's a very interesting test of your aesthetic sensibilities.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, we could go on about this for a while, and maybe we'll come back to it. But I think without further ado, we should mention that you, up until a couple of years ago, were the editor, quote-unquote, editor-in-chief, I guess was your official title, of ArtNet magazine. Is that the way that you would refer to it?
Yes.
Yeah. So ArtNet still very much exists in auction and listing form and what have you, but the magazine, as of a couple of years ago, stopped. And can you talk about the story of why that happened?
Well, the magazine was shut down and discontinued 2 years ago in June. So that would be in 2012.
Right.
And it had run for 16 years since 1996. We founded it.
Right.
And I think we had a really good run.
Yeah.
And I was really happy to get the job, and I was really happy to retire.
Mm-hmm.
because I retired directly to full-time, you know, painting work in my studio.
Oh, wow.
But I should say, I don't want to, you know, go on here too much, but I should say that ArtNet reinvented its sort of editorial function just 6 months ago or so. And now they have something called ArtNet News, and they send out a daily newsletter. They've hired a lot of, well-known writers, and it has a new editor. And actually, the company is selling ads against the magazine now. And that, according to a report that just came out yesterday, that is the fastest growing segment of ArtNet's revenue streams. And the thing that's great about ArtNet is it has so many different revenue streams.
Right.
And finally, like, editorial is able to contribute to it. I was never really that able to contribute to revenues when I was there.
Right. Well, yeah. So did you have a hand in actually founding it, or did sort of a colleague slash friend of yours hire you to sort of run the editorial side?
ArtNet is run by an art dealer, a German art dealer named Hans Neuendorf, who started his gallery in the 60s, and he started in Hamburg, and he sold pop art. He'd drive a truck to Paris and pick up some things from Ileana Sonnabend and drive it to Hamburg and sell it to German collectors. Mm-hmm. He was quite the pioneer. He was one of the founders of the Cologne Art Fair, which is Europe's oldest contemporary art fair.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to him in the 80s was when the computer revolution began, he caught the computer bug and started to make an auction database of prices at where collectors and other interested people could look up the prices, look up the record of auction sales, and it would help them appraise artworks. Before he set up this database, and it was a long and difficult and expensive process to mm-hmm. set it up, it sort of cost more to make than they could sell it for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you would see a painting for sale, and you would have no idea really of how to place it in the market because there weren't any really readily available public records of prior sales prices. The two major auction houses, Sotheby's and Christie's, each had their own records, but what Hans' genius was to combine it all together and make it illustrated. I think he made one of the first illustrated databases. I hope I'm not being too technical.
No. Basically, that's a good important
basically,
history.
Then, you know, subscribers for, I think, $30 a month, or it's $30 for 8 searches. You can look up, if you have an Andy Warhol flower painting and you're curious what Andy Warhol flower paintings have been selling for lately,
right.
You can look that up on the ArtNet database. And subscribers to the database now, I think that for ArtNet, that's one of the companies, that's the company's largest revenue stream.
Right.
It's funny since it's been 2 years since I worked there for me to be talking about it, but the company still owns 16 years of my work, so I still identify with it, even though I'm not connected with the company anymore.
How did he come to hire? So he hired you then at its founding? Yeah.
Yes, he hired me. In fact, before that, I was doing the news page at Art in America magazine.
Okay.
And I did a news story on his auction database, which in the pre-internet days you would access via phone modem.
Right.
I don't know if any of your listeners remember phone modems, but you would access via phone modem. And I did a little story on that. And when he decided in 1996 to launch his operation on the web, you know, and set up gallery websites and the auction database, he decided to have a magazine too. He had a grand vision. He wanted to replicate the whole art world in the digital space. And so he hired me to do that.
Wow.
So, because he knew me because I had written a little thing about him and he hired me. It was a great opportunity.
Yeah.
For me. And, you know, we forget a little bit the opportunities for art critics prior to the digital era were much more constrained, much more limited.
Right.
And the computer revolution really opened things up for all of us.
Was this position that you had a full-time position? Was it more, even though you were the editor, was it more of a freelance type of situation?
Oh, no, that was a job. That was a real job.
You had to show up in an office.
Oh yes,
mm-hmm.
It was a real job. I went every day, and like all jobs that are labors of love, I probably put in 12, 15 hours of work a day. You know,
right.
You never stop working if you're into it.
Right.
That's one of the reasons I was. I sat in front of a computer for so much of my life.
Right.
Now I'm just glad to be sitting in front of an easel.
Yeah, yeah. And so let's give me and people listening a little bit of context. Did you get a bachelor's in art or a master's in art, and then you wound up getting a day job in art writing, or what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, I graduated from college here in New York way back in 1972.
Wow.
And all I had was a BA. And
from where?
I had no idea. I graduated from Columbia University.
Okay,
I went to
Columbia
College.
Okay.
Uptown.
Uh-huh.
So I'm an Ivy League kid.
Yes, you are.
I can't say that I studied very hard. But
back when you could breeze through school, right? Back in those days.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, you know, there were always these demonstrations on campus, and they'd shut it down, and there'd be no finals. That happened to me. That happened to me twice: once for Vietnam and once for Cambodia.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
And I took some art history courses, and I took a course, a seminar, led by a man named Brian O'Doherty, and it was called Writing Art Criticism. And he, at the time, was also editor of Art America magazine, a job he had for a year, I think, or a year and a half. And I started writing reviews for Art America in the 1973.
Wow.
And at the same time, with two of my classmates, we moved down to Soho and started our own art magazine, which was called Art Right Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we printed it on newsprint, and we distributed it for free in galleries. And from there, you know, I went to work for Art America part-time, starved to death for 20 years.
Right. Well, I was going to say, for the length of Art Right, did you get to the point where you had advertising, or not quite there?
Oh, yes, we had advertising. One of the editors of the magazine, one of my partners, was a woman from Hungary, a first-generation immigrant named Edith Dayak, and she was fearless. And she could sell ads, and she could go into the galleries and talk to the dealers and sell ads. I was the pointy-headed intellectual writer of the group. I was
right.
much too shy to actually talk to art dealers.
Right.
But she sold ads. But back in the 70s, the important thing to remember is that that was the decade of alternative spaces. And
mm-hmm.
the New York State Council on the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts were very liberal in the grants they would give to artists for their projects. So we were able to survive on grant money as well as earned income. But everything was much cheaper then. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I think I paid $160 a month and lived in a 4,000 square foot Soho loft.
Right, right. And so even though during that, you know, many year run as being an art critic for Art in America, your expenses were pretty low.
Well, yes, you know, yes. Yes, I did... It was pretty. I didn't make very much money. I mean, that's a dumb thing to talk about, but like going into art criticism is no way to earn a living.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I couldn't do anything else. You know, I'm not one of those people who sees control of the state. I kind of back my way through life.
Well, speaking,
but it was exciting. It's fun.
Yeah,
you know, it's fun to remember now.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, and you still live in Manhattan, right? Correct. So I imagine
yes.
that you've seen just about the complete evolution of the real estate market in Manhattan.
Yes, it's tough now.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen? I mean, for among other ways we could look at it, have you seen artists? Particularly what you can categorize it for me, but say the last 10 years or so, depart in droves?
Well, you know, I don't, generalizations like that make me uneasy.
Okay.
One thing that's clearly happened is that if you, I always imagine Manhattan as a toothpaste tube and somebody, or I should say a paint tube, and somebody stepped on it and the paint squirted out in all different directions. So,
right.
So there are artist colonies, as I'm sure you know, all through Brooklyn and going deeper into Brooklyn now, over into Jersey and into the Bronx. Staten Island may still be a little bit immune. Queens, you know, I have my studio in Queens.
Yeah.
And so it's just broadened out immensely. I think that can be said about art scenes everywhere. I think art is everywhere in the U.S. I don't know, for those of us who are urban junkies, setting up in Portland, Oregon, or or Philadelphia may not, you know, give the same juice as being in Manhattan, but I think there is art everywhere, and there are art scenes everywhere, aren't there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was simply making that generalization based on a conversation I had with a woman artist who lives and works in Harlem, I believe, that, you know, it was like she was one of the last artists, you know, working in Manhattan, basically, you know what I mean? So I was sure there are plenty of them, but they all sort of like, you know, establish themselves in your generation, roughly, you know, and that way they were able to stay. Otherwise, it's people like the Kostabis and the Koonses of the world, to use another lame generalization, who can afford to be there.
Well, people keep coming. We try to discourage it. But people keep
right,
coming.
Right.
I personally would discourage any young talented artist from coming here.
Yeah.
We need no more. We need none of those. We got plenty.
Yeah.
But they keep coming, and you know, I suppose there's a subtext in that many members of the art community maybe have an allowance, one could say.
Well, or, said, yes.
You know, have income, or
yep,
get help. I mean, I know many artists of both kinds, right? I know artists who have had to work hard and make it on their own, and I know artists who I don't know how they have gotten by all these years. So,
right, right.
You know, that's not really talked about in polite society, but that is one of the hidden subtexts of the whole art business, is that it's sort of a pastime for the wealthy,
yeah,
rather than, you know, the working class.
So, yeah, absolutely, right.
But there are exceptions, so.
Well, let's get revisit ArtNet for a moment. I'm just curious to know some of your other sort of more anecdotal memories of the experience. And I'll start out by, because I used to read it intermittently, and I know that one of your colleagues, I don't know, maybe one of your staff that you hired, wasn't he named Charlie Finch? And he was a very, like Mark Kostabi, but in a slightly different way, very sensational, gossipy sort of writer. And I know he got, he was actually fun to read, but you kind of, you know, wanted to hate him a little bit at the same time.
Oh, yes. He was a real lightning rod.
Right.
Or he was a loose cannonball on the deck of the art world. Charlie is actually a genius and a brilliant writer.
Uh-huh.
And if you thoroughly look at his text, you'll see all kinds of things. He wrote things that were very provocative and even off the wall, but he also wrote all kinds of other things, things that were kind. He liked to promote young artists and things that were intelligent. He did this great analysis of Beckmann's triptychs. And I really like Charlie. He wrote some really, really funny things. And he was my secret weapon. When we first launched the magazine, I remember hanging around with a couple of other art critics, and they were making fun of me. And I said to myself, I need to get somebody to kick these guys in the ass. So I called up Charlie, and we worked together, I think, for almost the entire time, for 15 years. And he would write a lot. He got paid next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always supply copy. And as he says, his reputation as the best art critic of his generation is established. He doesn't have to do anything else.
Interesting.
So,
do you see it that... How would you categorize, I'm putting it another way, my question, how would you categorize ArtNet, or how would you describe ArtNet as far as its role in the evolution of art writing? My sense is that it was made art writing more accessible. I'm not going to use the word like popularize or anything like that, but it did seem more accessible, and you gave people an alternative to sort of the more academic writings of the magazines, particularly art form.
I think that's true. You can say that. I wouldn't want to be too grandiose and make claims that were too large.
Right.
We did have one very intellectual writer who I liked very much. I liked very much Donald Cuspet. Mm. And he's for me, he was a real model of interpretation and clarity. Mm-hmm. Donald can write densely, and people think of him as somebody who writes impenetrable prose. But for us, I think he always wrote things that were very accessible and brimming with ideas and interesting interpretations. Hans Neuendorf, the publisher, the art dealer who ran Artnet, would say to me, "Walter, you need to create a new kind of art criticism." And I'd say to him, "Hans, I am creating a new kind of art criticism." And it was partly at his instigation, one of the things we would do would be to include prices in some of the articles. And, you know, that's pretty ordinary, but I would try to get the things that were very much embedded in the reality of the situation. Things that, like text that would maybe quote the artist or describe the opening or
right.
mention what the things are selling for. If you read a review of an art show in, say, the New York Times or Art in America magazine, you don't even know the things are for sale.
Right.
Right? And so I would always try to embed the text, especially the things I wrote. I wrote a regular column called Weekend Update.
Right.
That I would try to embed it in sort of a lived reality, or at least that's what I tell my boss when he'd say to me, you know, we need to write something. We need to invent a new kind of art criticism. Because he was thinking of Henry Luce, who, when he launched, was it Life magazine or Time? When he launched Time magazine, there was a certain amount of talk that he had created a new kind of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hans wanted to do that with art criticism. But that was, you know, endeavors like that are difficult. I never had anybody come to me and say, "Oh, man, you're great. You've invented a new kind of art writing."
So. I was just going to say, did anybody criticize you for, you know, including sale figures or what have you?
No, not really.
Yeah.
Not really. You know, when it comes to writing, what you kind of get yelled at if you make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I people would be upset because there would be errors. But I'd always say, well, that gives the readers something to do. they can proofread and then
right.
we'll make changes later.
Right. Talk a little bit about your experience, you know, being an art critic on the scene. I mean, I'll just give you a little setup by saying I went and saw a show late spring, say, and at this very hot Los Angeles gallery, and I heard some of the staff in the office just after this dealer had left saying, you know, so and so was just here, you know, probably to the dealer. So I'm just wondering if you ever sort of got that kind of sense when you were in a gallery.
That they're paying attention to
that you're aware of, that they're aware of you're being there. That, you know, it's like a restaurant when a reviewer comes in, whatever, that kind of dynamic.
I don't know if I was ever that much of a Bigfoot,
right?
And you know, if you're Peter Shelvall or Jerry Salter or Roberta Smith, that happens,
right?
It's interesting. The critics are treated a certain way. I mean, I don't know how to say this and be clear. Like when I stopped writing criticism and began being an artist, I felt much more loved, right, than when I was a critic.
Mm-hmm.
Critics are loved also, but they're sort of hated and resented.
Yeah.
And the whole art world is designed to love the artists. Of course, artists struggle and artists are rejected, but the whole art world is designed to love the artist, and critics are sort of everyone's enemy.
Let me interject for a second, Walter. To take your three examples, Roberta Smith, Jerry Saltz, and Peter Sheldahl, like, you know, perhaps the most well-known critics in this country, would you say that they're seen as enemies at all? I mean, I feel like Jerry Saltz definitely has a huge fan base. I don't know, maybe people love to hate him as well, but what's your sense of those three, for example?
Well, as you say, they're very popular, and I think that people like them, and I don't know, it's so complicated. I would say sometimes that the critic is the only person who's truly independent, who can only speak the truth, and as a consequence, critics are paid very poorly. But of course, there are some top critics like Roberta and Jerry and Peter who earn, and me when I had my job, who earn very respectable livings and get a lot of respect. And in fact, you could say that people even kowtow to those artists, I mean, to those critics, right? People chase after them for their approval. That much we know from watching Jerry on Facebook. Jerry has sort of transformed on Facebook, I think, his identity and the identity of the critic. He has turned the critic from a sort of defensive, intellectual, argumentative, crabby person into a really open, open person who you can't insult, and who like conducts a big public discussion. That's fascinating. So, mm-hmm. But you've got to admit that if you ask an artist about critics, they will be fairly contemptuous in general. Artists do not like critics, because critics come and say like mean things about their work, and who likes that? artists never forget. You know, if you're a critic and you say something mean about an artist, they'll remember it forever.
True, but if they if they say loving things about their work, they do kind of love them, don't they? And they talk about it on Facebook.
That also.
Yeah,
I don't know. Your listeners can compare their own experiences. I remember Brooks Adams did a review of one of my first shows back in the early 80s, and I don't remember anything about the review. Now, I remember he said I was painting, what was the word he used? Now I can't remember. What a bad storyteller I am in my old age.
No, it's okay. But basically, he dissed your show.
I remembered like the one bad thing that I was pissed off about.
Yeah,
and I remember very little else. But you know, critics get to talk about everything.
Yeah,
and artists get to talk about one thing, themselves.
Right.
Critics have to talk about anything. But the biggest change in my life is that when I was the editor of an art magazine, I had to work really hard to be in front of everything, the news, to be on top of everything, to know what was going on, to go places, and to know things. I had to know things.
Yeah.
Now, as an artist, I don't have to know any of that. In fact, I don't even have to care about it.
Right.
What I have to know about is what's going on in my studio.
Right. Yeah, and we should get there at some point, but I want to talk more about being an art critic. Where you mentioned the kowtowing, so how are you kowtowed to?
Oh, well, I don't think I was ever really kowtowed to. I wasn't that good at being a suck-up. You know, a large part, one way anyway, to get ahead as a critic is to be a suck-up. And one of the things you want to do is write glowing profiles of important artists.
Right.
And as an artist myself, strangely, I found myself very reluctant to do that.
Yeah.
Incapable almost. I could write nice profiles of my friends. You know, I've written several profiles of my friends, which ended up helping them not at all. I think compared to a lot of critics, like a lot of critics, I'm still kind of on the outside.
Yeah.
Even though I was, even Artnet Magazine, for all those years and for all the good work it did, still sort of remained on the outside, I think.
Wow. Okay, because you were going to art fairs and everything, and you know, so you felt like an outsider there. That's how you were treated.
Oh my God. Well, the art fair reporting was one of our pioneering efforts, and I got that impetus from the publisher from Neuendorf who was like, you know, you've got to go to the art fair and report right from the fair. And we did that. You know, I've been to Art Basel Miami Beach every year since it was founded. And, you know, I've been to I can't even remember the names of the fairs. I've been to Arco and Art Cologne, and used to be one in Berlin, and I went to Fries. Right. All those fairs, reported from all of them.
Mm-hmm. Was that fun?
At an art fair, they don't care about critics at all.
Right.
At an art fair, all they care about is collectors and
right.
business.
Yeah.
They don't have time to talk to, you know, the guys who are scribbling things down on a pad.
Were you ignored even though you love them?
Well, you go around and you talk to people.
Yeah.
You know, and you talk to people and try to find things out. That's basically what you do. You go look at things. Great fun. So, but it's, you know, in terms of the social glue that connects the whole art world together, the sort of one of the hidden aspects of the art business is the social connections and those, like, who gets invited to the opening dinners.
Yeah.
And it's not like I was frequently invited. You know? I occasionally have been to them, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not really part of the social scene. Much.
Hmm.
Maybe
interesting.
I need to dress better. I don't know. I was just never a part of that. You have to want that kind of thing and
yeah.
go after it. And I never particularly wanted that. I mean,
were your artist friends part of that scene? Some of them.
Some of them, but I think more like if you think of a writer like Peter Sheldahl.
Yeah.
He was like some of these people are like Athena emerging full blown from the brow of Jupiter. Like Peter Sheldahl was a top art critic from the moment he appeared on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a poet for a while, but then
yeah.
he was a resident art critic at a new magazine called 7 Days, and then he worked for The Voice, and then he worked for New York Magazine, and now he works for The New Yorker. And he was a big deal from the very beginning. So if you're trying to get some press for your show, and you're Marion Goodman, and you have an Anselm Kiefer show, you're going to invite Peter to the dinner afterwards.
And to what extent do you think those kinds of invitations get a critic to indeed write about that subject?
Well, that part is really ridiculous when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why would you write about somebody just because they gave you a free meal?
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
But do you know what it is? Is it cements these social relationships.
Yeah.
And you're much more likely to write about somebody because you've met them, you're friendly with them, you like
right.
them.
Right.
It's a lot more easier to be sucked into an individual artist's aesthetic point of view if you're actually there with them and you know them and you become a part of it.
Right.
Right. If you just somebody and comes and looks at this stuff and you say, what is all that gray crap and straw on the canvas? That's nothing. that's easy to do. But if you're there and they draw you in, I think that's sort of the social
right.
you know, dynamic of the whole thing.
Right.
That's no big deal.
Yeah. Do you think though that to what extent do you think to take those three critics that we've been talking about? They are able to, you know, keep their distance, be objective, despite being wined and dined.
Oh, it's an amazing now that you mention it, because they're all completely independent
mm-hmm.
and completely cantankerous.
Right.
And all three of them are celebrated for, what should we call it, their injudiciousness. You know,
right.
Peter is cranky, Roberta is cranky. Jerry can be really harsh.
Yeah.
But Jerry's harsh in a sort of cheerful way.
Mm-hmm.
Peter and Roberta, I think, are very serious.
Yeah.
Peter is very opinionated. He knows what he likes. He knows what he thinks is good. He's very opinionated.
I think he's got good taste, by the way.
Well, you know, he has his favorites. He likes the Jeff Koons show. He loves Cindy Sherman. You know, so anyway, they're it's amazing. They actually sell their independence. They sell their independence, and if their views go against you, all you can do is shrug and, you know, think that maybe next time it'll be better.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get to your artist life. When did that start? From what we've heard so far, you were writing at first. When did the art making start happening?
Well, I kind of backed into that too. I remember in first grade, I was like the best drawer, and I could draw. I would draw shootouts, high noon shootouts, and the bad guy would have a black bandana on his face, and the marshal would have a star. And I was in first grade. So, but I sort of was painting through the 70s, and it was only at the beginning of the 80s that I really hit on something that I liked, which was making paintings of these pulp images from old paperbacks, which back in the 80s were a lot more obscure than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a show in 1980. I think I was in a group show at Metro Pictures. And here's an example of how it happens. I'm sitting in the studio. I have like part-time jobs and I'm living in Soho and I'm sitting in the studio making these paintings and our friends are coming by and I know Helene Weiner, one of the directors of Metro Pictures, from before when she used to run Artist Space, an alternative space.
Right.
And she calls me up and says, I hear you're doing some interesting work. Could you bring something over that we could see? So I rolled up like a picture I'd made on construction paper. She said, that's good. We'll put it in the group show. And so after that, I showed with Metro Pictures for 6 years to 1986.
Wow.
And so it's like when I say I like backed into it, I didn't like pitch my slides. I didn't go around and ask to have shows. You know, it's only in my 60s that I've developed a personality that is capable of doing that. But back then, I couldn't do it. So I had a bunch of shows at Metro Pictures in the 80s. And at the same time, a lot of my friends were opening galleries in the East Village.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the East Village scene was, you know, 82 to 85.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd show there also and hang out with all these kids. You know, we showed at nightclubs. It was a very sort of bar-centric scene. They were mostly in their 20s. I was in my 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people in their 20s, they go out and get drunk. I think they still do that, don't they?
Yeah, apparently. So were you then considering yourself an artist at the time and as a writer was more of a side thing? Or how did you look at it at the time in the early 80s?
Well, it was fairly undefined.
Yeah.
I think back then I was really uncertain about that. Declaring myself, I think I would have felt ambiguous. I didn't walk around saying I was an art critic.
Yeah.
I thought that was, so I think I felt presumptuous or anxious or embarrassed to do that. And, you know, I did okay with the paintings. I painted these romances and I painted portraits of people. And then I painted, I made spin paintings. You know, I made some abstract paintings. I had been over in the 70s to Germany and seen a show of Gerhard Richter paintings in Frankfurt, I think. And he had this big museum show, and he made, was news to me then, but he made figurative paintings and abstract paintings both.
Right.
And that was liberating. I thought that was good.
Yeah.
It seems odd that in the art business, it's about being creative, and yet we all tie ourselves down to a singular autograph style. And that seems kind of funny to me. If you work in many different modes, you're considered a dilettante. Right?
Right.
You have to focus on one thing to be thought serious. Of course, things have changed a little bit last decade or so.
Right. But generally, the market is—it's the market that's, for one, in one way or another, that's pushing people to have their brand. And if they stray from that brand, it becomes diluted. Isn't that kind of one way?
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. In fact, that's one of the main pieces of advice that Neuendorf, the guy who founded ArtNet, gave me.
Mm.
That, because I still paint a lot of different images. I paint things that are interesting.
Yeah.
And originally it was about painting things that had desire in them, that were about desire,
mm-hmm.
about romance,
mm-hmm.
about passion.
Right.
So now I paint cheeseburgers. I used to paint people kissing. I'm glad you laughed. That's like a joke I've used several times.
It's a really good joke. So you had this show. Was it just this past spring of 2014?
Yes. You know, the one thing I've realized, in my old age, is that if you're going to be a professional artist, you've got to have shows. You've got to work towards shows constantly. You've got to be out there. You're engaged in like a big public conversation with your fellow artists in the art world. And you need to show regularly. I had a show that opened at the end of May at a new gallery on the Lower East Side called Lynch Tham. It's run by Lawrence Lynch and B. Tham, who's from Singapore.
Uh-huh.
And those paintings, that was a new body of work. Those were my normcore paintings. Paintings of people, figure studies, I called it. Paintings of people paintings of models from advertisements for middle brow and down market retailers like
right.
Macy's or Land's End.
Right.
And so that was a lot of fun. I sold some paintings and the critics are still being very nice to me.
Right. Because they're your colleagues and they respect you as a colleague, right?
Yeah, I suppose I'm still pulling in all those chits. I look forward to the day that I become so big that people are mad at me. Negative reviews.
Right.
Right? A negative review means that people are pissed at you.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and
I look forward to that.
Yeah. I don't know if you've had this conversation with yourself, but if you were to sort of step into your critic mode, maybe this is impossible to do, how would you look at your paintings, say this show that you mentioned, and critique them, if you will?
Oh, well, that's an immediate problem. Of course, the thing I realize now, I can only say good things about myself.
Right.
It was a fabulous show, brilliant, wonderfully done. The guy's a real painter. Nobody's made paintings like this before. I get this from my wife, who doesn't like my self-depreciating sense of humor.
Right.
And I say to her, what about Woody Allen, or better yet, Lena Dunham?
Yeah.
They became very successful by being, failures.
Right.
What about them? But from the other side, to answer your question.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that I'm an 80s artist, and my paintings are like my colleagues from the 80s. So these paintings of people from fashion advertisements, they're like Richard Prince's earliest work. Actually, he did those things in the 70s.
Yeah.
But I think of them also, these are paintings that directly address you. They address the spectator. They're saying, look at me, I'm happy. I'm wearing these clothes and you should buy them.
Right.
That's what they say in the original ads. That's what the paintings say. They're these figures that look at the viewer and smile. And you can think about all the paintings you've seen where they're looking at you smiling. There aren't that many. But it is very much like, say, Barbara Kruger, whose artworks from the 80s are involved in direct address. They with their text, or Jenny Holzer, they directly address the spectator.
Right.
Or they're like Robert Longo, the Men in the City series he did. And in fact, one of the pictures, I think it's from a Land's End ad for winter clothes. It's, I think, five figures all sort of goofing around together like they were having a snowball fight or something. I put it in there because I wanted something to represent winter.
Mm-hmm.
But it resembles very much a series that Robert Longo did, I think, called Corporate Wars. It's pretty arcane. But he did some bas reliefs of like boardroom fighting, boardroom tussles. So I'm very much with all my colleagues.
Yeah. Well, let me throw out a sort of more challenging question for self-analysis, and that is being a, you know, a critic who has gone around to see what's, you know, what's new, what's at the fairs and so on. You've obviously seen, you know, the cutting edge, the avant-garde, for lack of a better word, work. And I just wonder if how many frequently you've had the conversation in your head, you know, do I want to go in that direction? Do I want to challenge both myself and my audience by making work in that vein? Or do I want to make work that is more a la the Matisse school, you know, of the comfy chair?
You know, it's funny that it's funny how little calculations of that sort actually play in one's artistic decisions, at least I think.
Uh-huh.
I think artists can only do what they do. They can't suddenly do something else. And if you're, say, a painter who's, you know, could I turn into Sarah Z tomorrow?
Right.
Could I, like, gather bunches of junk and arrange it in weird?
Right.
She's not one of my favorites. Her work I think of as representing waste of time. This is art that speaks to a waste of time. You're like arranging all the stuff in some kind of pretty arrangement, which is a perfectly good thing for art to be about. Right? Art is kind of a waste of time in many ways. But could I turn around and could I suddenly do that? I suppose I could.
Yeah.
No, it would be, I don't know how you make these decisions. Early on, when I first started, being an artist is about, being a painter is about having a subject. Like, what is your subject going to be? And I see the subjects that my fellow painters choose, like, say, Eric Fitchell or John Curran, both much more accomplished and successful than I. But I see a certain uncertainty in their selections of subjects. You know, Eric will have a different sort of subject. Similarly, Cindy Sherman, you know, we know what she does, but
yeah,
she'll have like it'll be different sort of periods or types of work. And for instance, I think Eric's latest show, which were paintings of like family snapshots. Him and all his pals on vacation in Barbados or at the beach or something. And so it really, what his subject is his friends and family. It's very sort of tribal. And I like that a lot because that seems to be very elementary and very essential and very, very authentic. He's also done a series of paintings of like a ballet dancing troupe.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a series of paintings of bullfighters, like all those kind of sort of kitschy subjects. I like those a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, what is your subject? And that's a question that haunts me a lot.
Well, romance and cheeseburgers and now sort of second-tier catalogs, right?
Well, it's interesting to transition that non-art imagery into an art context and see what kind of meaning it has.
Yeah.
But after the vast success of the Jeff Koons show, which I like, and I think if anything, that show demonstrates that the collapse of that Jeff has engineered between the avant-garde and the commercial world.
Mm-hmm.
He's collapsed them. He's made them the same. That makes me want to somehow inject a new political consciousness into what I'm doing. I don't know how. I never wanted to do that before.
Right.
You know, I never wanted to make paintings that were like social realism.
Right.
But maybe it would be a good time to start. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I think you should go for it. Seriously. So
campaign cheeseburgers for everyone.
I think that's true. So you mentioned that you moved on from the art critic slash editor career 2 years ago into being an artist. So are you, is that how you're supporting yourself, if you don't mind my asking?
Oh, well, that's sort of a complicated situation. What I'm doing now is spending the money I've built up over the years.
Right.
And waiting for something to happen.
Right.
Obviously I put my, most of my eggs in the successful art. I had a painting selling business.
Yeah.
So I need to sell paintings. My wife works.
That's nice.
My wife works.
Yeah.
And one of the things that your younger listeners should take heed of is that the things you accumulate in your 20s and 30s, if you hold on to them until you're in your 60s, maybe you can sell the goddamn stuff for a few bucks. You know?
Right.
So I was never really very good at that, but I do have a few things which I, you know, as the need arises, I will sell.
I'm guessing you're not going to mention who those works are, right?
Well, some of them I want to do it on the QT.
Yeah.
It was only 10 years ago that I bought I bought three drawings for $300. What the hell was that guy's name? I sold them to his gallery the other day for $20,000.
Oh my goodness. What gallery was it?
I'm not telling you. But when people complain about the high price of art and, you know, the inflated value of real estate, the idea is, of course, and this is obvious, that over the span of your life, you can take advantage of that and actually benefit from it.
Right.
You know, it's tough. You have to – when it comes to art as an investment, I made many, many wrong choices.
I have
– like most of what I have is not worth anything.
Right. Let me ask you something actually, Walter, because I looks like I will be acquiring – a work by an artist who was hot in the, say, late 80s in Los Angeles. And this work apparently is worth nothing right now. But I haven't hung it up. I haven't gotten a good look at it yet. But I'm thinking, if I appreciate it, because I appreciated a lot of his work from some of his work from that time, that's fine with me. I mean, what's the deal with the artist that you have who has no value? I mean, do you still appreciate it, or do you think not only financially did you make bad moves, but also aesthetically or what have you made bad moves?
Well, you know, you have all kinds. If you bought a lot of work, you have all kinds of reactions to it.
Yeah.
I have, you know, my apartment is filled with works, and the walls are filled, and it's very easy to keep them, but at this stage, it's easy to say, oh, I've owned that enough, I'm going to sell it and use the money to pay the rent.
Right.
But I have an absurd number of artworks. I have artworks by famous artists that are atypical and aren't worth anything. I have works by my friends who aren't worth anything. I bought at Christie's for $600 a work on paper by an unknown third generation Abex a painter who taught me in college,
named
Aja Junkers.
Uh-huh.
I had a great uncle, my grandmother's brother, who was a painter, and his name's Frederick Wagner, and his paintings actually traded auction for reasonable prices. I have a bunch of those, but they're not really worth anything. And my wife had a couple of great uncles who were also great artists. I'm looking at one of those now. So I have an Ellen Birkenblit. Mm-hmm. I have a John Lurie. You know those. I have a Mike Bidlow plaster head, which I think I paid $100 for, and maybe worth $1,000. So obviously, I'm not going to be able to, you know, live very long off of that.
Right, right. So I think the interesting takeaway from thinking about these things is, you know, when you look at a work by, you know, a really now valuable artist, next to a work that you really like, or next to a work that at one time at least you really like, and you know, and you can sort of consider how much investment, so to speak, you're putting into the work that has market value versus the work that doesn't, in your perception.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can, yeah. You know, it's the people who make money off of in the art market are usually art dealers.
Yeah.
Art dealers and collectors.
Yep.
People like us have a much poorer track record.
Yeah.
And the one thing that is seems to be a rule of thumb is, and they used to say this back in the 70s when they'd say art is not an investment, buy what you love and buy the best.
Yeah.
They'd say buy the best. So obviously if you want to speculate in art, you would buy from a good gallery an important work by a young artist.
Right.
Chances are you'll pay, these days you'll pay $15,000.
Right.
For a big painting by a young artist at a hip but B-level gallery.
Right.
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 And the idea is that in 2 years they'll be worth 10 times as much.
Right.
But that's a gamble. Do you have $15K to gamble with? I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you get little things that in the end don't. Yeah, you know, rare. Sometimes they go up. Like, I will tell you the name of this guy if I could remember. Wade Guyton. I bought at a benefit like these three little drawings by Wade Guyton for $100 each, and now he's like a god.
Yeah.
And
so were these inkjet prints?
Yes, they were from his first series of inkjet prints.
Right.
I think he took pages from an Art Cologne catalog.
Right.
And put them through the printer and made a stripe on them.
Yeah.
And I went to one dealer, and he said, I'll give you $10,000 in cash on Monday, no questions asked. I said, let me think about it. And I ran into a friend of mine on the sidewalk and asked them what they thought about that. I said, well, why don't you take it over to his gallery?
Yeah.
His Petzl.
Yeah.
Why don't you take it over to Petzl Gallery?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I think we can do better than that. And they gave me $20,000 for them. You know, several months later.
Nice. Yeah.
That kind of anecdote is not, it's not the proof of the pudding. You know what I mean? That will not happen every time.
No, of course not. Did part of regret not having one of them to keep on hand just for the pleasure of it, or what, how did you feel about that?
Well, you know, that kind of stuff, that kind of pleasure is easy to let go.
That is true. That is true wisdom right there. Is there
honestly
anything, Walter, that in our final moments that you would like to cover that I may have neglected?
Let me say that after 2 years ago when I left ArtNet, I was hired by Artspace.com.
Right.
And I wrote a column every 2 weeks for them, and I enjoyed doing that very much. They paid me. It paid me well, about $1,000 for 800 words.
Nice.
I should say $1,000 for about 800 words.
Right.
It paid me very well, and I got to write some things I really enjoyed. And
you wrote in ArtSpace. I did look at some of your materials, and you recently wrote about the studio visit, which is something, again, you're kind of sort of backing your way into. Just as we sort of wrap up, are there any studio visits recently of note since you wrote that piece, or that are coming up that you want to mention?
Well, I got to get I got to get that studio operation going.
<You
know? laughs> Right now, it's sort of going to be a shipping depot because Barry is borrowing a lot of pictures, a lot of the old pictures from collectors, and I think he's going to send a truck and pick most of them up from my studio. Will be the kind of depot, and now that's the hardest thing is to sell those. You know, you sell the pictures and then they disappear and you lose them. You know, it's much easier for me now to sell some other artist's stuff. I regret losing my grip on all those early works.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah, sure. You tell yourself better than me.
Yeah,
it's better. It's safer in their hands than in mine.
Yeah.
but from Kent Carmi, I of course kept no records.
Yeah, right.
I don't know where a lot of pictures are. So.
And does Metro Pictures have any records of those works?
You know, I stopped showing with Metro in 1986, and then I had a show with them in 2008.
Wow.
So I'm not altogether sure what the situation is.
Right.
You know, I hate doing clerical work. I have some files I suppose I should look through. I keep putting it off.
I hear you. I hear you on that. Believe me. Walter, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Likewise, and thanks a lot for thinking of me.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're out.
And there you have it. Thank you again to Walter Robinson for a great chat, for coming on the show. There are more New York artists, writers, what have you, that are represented at theconversationpod.com on past episodes. If you choose to explore that part of the country, of course, there are a lot of Southern Californians that dominate, but it's a melange of different types. And there are a few different ways you can support the show if you like what you're hearing and appreciate the content here. You can donate to the show via PayPal through the website, theconversationpod.com. That money simply goes towards keeping the show going. This is a listener-supported show when listeners support. So if you haven't contributed anything financially yet, your financial donation would be very much appreciated. You can also leave a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the website. Leave a nice review, and that helps other people find the show, which is always great. Love to grow the show, and that's the way the world works. So even if you do not use iTunes, you can still link through the site, leave a review there. That is much appreciated. Of course, you can also spread the word and follow, become a fan on social media, also linked, again, through theconversationpod.com. Little Facebook support is also nice, helps us reach sort of a critical mass, and of course the ego as well. Thank you for being here again. I hope you come back soon, and I will talk to you soon. Thank you very much.